Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, July 27th, 1967, President Lyndon B. Johnson establishes the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, also known as the Kerner Commission after its chair, Governor Kerner of Illinois. This commission is in response to what's known as the long, hot summer of 1967, a summer marked by rioting, violence, civil unrest, protest, much of it on behalf of and by Black and Latino communities in major cities around the country. There, of course, had been riots in Watts in 1965, Chicago 66, Newark 67, lots of unrest going on in this era. And there were riots in Detroit as the commission first gathered to meet. So, you know, we will get into all of this, but I will say that the Kerner Commission's results are notable for one, how frankly they painted a picture of why Black and brown communities were frustrated, and two, how quickly its findings were generally buried and spun and in many ways lost to history. But not entirely lost to history, because we are talking about it today. But more importantly, there is a new release of the Kerner Commission report, and included in there some writing on some lessons for today. And it is put together by Jelani Cobb, staff writer at The New Yorker, professor at Columbia Journalism School, and our special guest here today. So Jelani, welcome to the show. We've been wanting to have you on for a while, so thanks for doing this.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And of course, I'm joined as always by Nicole Hemmer of Columbia and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. Hello there.
Hey there.
Hello, Jody.
So, Jelani, I hinted a little bit at that timeline of how this commission comes together. Johnson convenes it in the summer of 67, riots still going on in parts of the country. You know, we're having such a fierce debate right now about commissions and attempts to sort of reckon with this era. And a lot of it is about these things getting dragged out and stuff not coming together. So, in terms of just that timing, I mean, does LBJ deserve any credit for this happening sort of quickly and in the moment?
Yeah, I mean, he does. I mean, so I think that, you know, LBJ has to grow up in public, you know, on matters of race in a way that very few presidents have had to do. You know, I think that probably people compare LBJ to Lincoln all the time, but Lincoln really had to grapple with deciphering the riddle of race, and all of his mistakes would be laid bare, you know, for the historical record. The things that he got right and the things that he got wrong, we'd recognize. And I think the same thing goes for LBJ. And so, you know, the fact that he creates the commission in the first place, the fact that it comes together, the fact that it doesn't, to his credit, given the kind of political operator that he was, he didn't appoint a set of political puppets who were going to just, you know, be his handpicked people who would deliver the report that he wanted. As a matter of fact, the report kind of got away from him. And that was part of the reason that those findings never really went anywhere in the administration. And so I think he does deserve credit for trying to grapple with the problem, even if, you know, he got more than he anticipated in terms of their response to it.
Yeah, I am so curious about the people who were on this commission and how they came to their conclusions. Because you think about something like the Moynihan Report, which had come out just a few years earlier, and you could imagine the Kerner Commission coming out with something like that, something that says, you know, this is a result of Black pathology and Black culture, and Black people really need to focus on fixing themselves and their communities. But the Kerner Commission is so different from that. I mean, how did they wind up somewhere so progressive and so frank about racism in the U.S.?
Yeah, so the other thing, another couple dynamics here. There are 12 people on the commission. 10 of the 12 people are white. You know, these are very much, it's bipartisan, but these are very much people who are in the kind of center of the political spectrum. You know, they're Republicans and Democrats. You know, the two Black people are Roy Wilkins, who was the executive secretary of the NAACP at that time, and Edward Brooke, you know, senator, who was the Black senator who was elected in Massachusetts. And so, you know, you have these two African Americans, but then, and Edward Brooke is very much a moderate, people would even consider conservative on these matters. They didn't have H. Rapp Brown, you know, in these meetings. But what happens is, I think the thing that the commission did was ask the fundamental questions. They didn't go to just the superficial concerns. So there's a whole section of that commission report that delves into the history of Black people in the United States. I mean, going back to the colonial era and walking through up to the 1960s. So when there are Black people who are angry in these cities, they're asking fundamentally, how did they even get to these cities? And how did the conditions that they're angry about arise? Now, there are some overtones of Moynihan in that report, if you kind of dig deep enough in there, you know, particularly when they talk about what the impact of poverty and joblessness and so on have been when on family structure. They skew, you can tell that there's a kind of Moynihanian, you know, skew in their writing. But I think it's the delving into the more fundamental questions that send them further and further to the left.
Can I just, I want to quote a passage, probably the best known passage from the report, that says, "Our nation is moving toward two societies, one Black, one white, separate and unequal." Mm-hmm. And then the report goes on to say, "What white Americans have never fully understood, but what the Negro can never forget, is that the white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto. White institutions created it, white institutions maintain it, and white society condones it." Mm-hmm. And that to me is so powerful, especially for when it was written, because it really lays bare, like, this is not a Black people problem. This mm-hmm. is actually a white supremacist problem. Mm-hmm. And we need to be honest about, like, who, where responsibility and where accountability lies, and how so many white Americans, if not have condoned, have definitely been complicit
right.
in how this system maintains itself.
So, I mean, I think that being the graph, the paragraph that people pull out and discuss, had as much to do with that report being buried as anything else. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're still having debate. If that report came out today, they would say it was critical race theory and it would ban it.
Yes.
You know? You yeah. could say this right now.
Right. Right. Because we're talking about culpability and complicity. Mm. And those are things that are not easy discussions in American society, especially as it relates to race. You know, we're more invested in a kind of absolution and, you know, the kind of waivers of innocence that you know, leave us to say that these are problems, like to the Moynihan analysis, that these are problems that were self-inflicted, et cetera. And so there's that. The other part of it is, you know, what makes it such a stark departure is that the standard boilerplate rhetoric among liberals of the 1960s, you know, people who were in favor of the civil rights movement and civil rights legislation, was that America's values were fundamentally sound, but Black people had just been an oversight, that, you know, we'd failed to live up to our values. You know, we're generally egalitarian, but we have to actually be what we say that we are, and so on. But in saying that white society condones it, that really had a different implication.
Let's talk about a few of the other findings of the report, and then a little bit more about the legacy and the way it's maybe been lost to history in some ways. But, you know, I'm curious about the balance between racial lens, a picture of race relations in this country, and what seems to be a very sort of stark economic lens and assessment. You know, in particular, there's passages about, you know, immigrant communities who came to this country and rose from poverty, and those being largely helped by the industrialization in this country, mm-hmm. and then Black communities trying to do the same thing, really suffering from deindustrialization. I mean, that's a very sort of economic and class lens that's pretty striking to me.
Yeah. And so, I mean, first off, one of the other things about Kerner that remains notable is the breadth of the analysis, because in addition to doing that, they also analyzed media, which virtually no one was doing, and issued this call for media to diversify and to change the way that it covers these communities, what they call then ghetto communities, et cetera. But on the issue of the comparison with immigrants, one of the things that happens, I think, is that all the representatives are indicted in some way, shape, or form. you know, the political system does not respond to the needs of these communities. There are a bunch of elected officials who are on this commission. Labor unions, which are so key to the development of the middle class, you know, particularly among people who had been immigrants and the children of immigrants, are by and large exclusionary, you know, for most of the first half of the 20th century as it relates to African Americans and their representatives of labor, you know, on this commission. The employment and hiring, all these things that, you know, everyone gets some share of the blame, you know, the culpability in the process of doing this. And so they look at the particularities, the kind of asterisk that's next to Black identity and how class and racism conflate into this kind of toxic symbiosis as it relates to the condition of Black people in the country. And really, the other thing, last thing that I'll say about this is that, you know, there's, we talked about Moynihan and kind of the shadow of Moynihan as they were writing this, but I really think, my kind of theory about this is that they were trying to replicate the impact that American Dilemma had 20 years earlier. Gunnar Myrdal's study of race in the United States really sets the benchmark and creates the kind of mandate for Cold War liberalism. And I think they thought they could reinvent the wheel with that. Lightning could strike twice, but they were in a very different political moment. And, you know, one of the reasons that we can see all the things that we can, all the changes and developments that we might attribute to American Dilemma, but the legacy of Kerner has been missed opportunity after missed opportunity.
So let's start to paint a picture of how this report gets received. And yeah, I don't know if buried is the right word, but let's start with Johnson himself. I think he maybe got, as you said, more than he bargained for. They also take a couple swipes at Johnson, and you know, he'd floated ideas that there were communists who were agitating for these riots, right? And they're like, nah, not so much, you know. So what is his reaction, and then how does that reflect the kind of larger, despite its popularity, the larger way in which this is received?
Yeah, I mean, and so the idea, one of the first things that indicates that this commission has gotten away from it, from him. And, you know, there's the old saying, not that these people were puppets, none of them were puppets, but there's the old political saying that's very useful, is, you know, always beware of puppets that begin pulling their own strings. And so the kind of parallel would be always beware of commissions that begin thinking for themselves. And so around the question with the communist infiltration or communist provocation, which would have been great, useful propaganda, you know, for the for the White House. And the commission is like, no, it, the problem is not the Soviet Union. The problem is us. And that's a very different kind of undertaking. And so, you know, the report comes out to this gangbusters response in terms of publishing and purchasing. But a very tepid response in the administration, and it shelved almost immediately. LBJ doesn't make any real significant acknowledgement of the findings, and it just is this thing that happened.
Just to draw a line under that point about popularity, this sold 1 million copies in the first week.
It's crazy.
That's...
We have three academic authors here who are all going, oh my God.
Yeah, that's, I mean, there's so much of the report that requires this reckoning, not just recognition, but reckoning, you know, and people's unwillingness, I think, to deal with that sent a huge message that, you know, okay, well, if this requires, you know, if this requires funds, if this requires actions, no, this is not a solution. and people move on very quickly.
You know, one of the interesting things about this report, which is that I had read smaller revised versions of it. Our version that we're putting out was intended for undergrad courses. So it's the essential Kerner. We tried to distill it down to the most relevant points and the most enduring points. But having read the entire sprawling 900-page manuscript, what was really rewarding was combing through the footnotes, as you know, everyone knows, like, you know, that's where the real information is. But one of the things, I was like working late at night and I just read this footnote and burst out laughing, you know, like I had lost it, you know, because it was so completely crazy. The commission had a footnote in one chapter acknowledging everyone who had been very helpful to, you know, their fact finding. And so they thanked one particular officer in the LAPD for his insight into the dynamics of riot policing and the most effective ways of doing community-based riot policing to create safety for all involved, you know, the officers and the community members. And so they gave a special acknowledgement and debt of gratitude to, I think he was captain at the time, Daryl Gates.
Of course.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Wow.
And of course, you know, by 1992, Ice Cube is talking about Daryl Gates. You know, the whole city of Los Angeles is on fire. That just kind of leaped out to me. You know, it's like this dude who you're thanking for his insights into riot policing will eventually sponsor the largest riot in response to police violence in the history of the entire country.
Well, that's, you know, amazing. It's like there's a whole story of not learning lessons to begin with, but I feel like so much of the American story is also unlearning lessons that you at one point did learn, you know, and possibly willfully unlearning them, you know. So, yeah. So as we wrap up, I mean, I'm curious if there's any sort of tidbit or smaller piece. I mean, that footnote story is great, but, you know, I do want to give a shout out to Farai Shadea, who has been on this show as a former colleague, but she has been championing the media lessons in the Kerner Report. And
that's
throughout
right.
this past year, you know, as media has been having a reckoning, she's been saying, you know, there was this thing in 1968 that we may want to look to. So are there other smaller, maybe more overlooked parts of the Kerner Report that you feel like really resonate today?
Yes. I also have to shout out to Matthew Gariglia, who I had the pleasure of having as a grad student when I was on faculty at UConn, now kind of full blossomed historian in his own right. And he helped tremendously with editing this project. And we had a conversation about, we were working on one section last year, and we were going over this paragraph where they were talking about police community relations. And, you know, they said that the ghetto, you know, which is obviously the term they were using then, the ghetto is over-policed. And they said that police were being used for every sort of concern in these communities. And that there really needed to be a alternate system of social resources that would respond in lieu of law enforcement. And they said that when you have law enforcement responding to particular problems that don't require law enforcement, you dramatically increase the likelihood that something will go awry. And half a century later, the same arguments were being made under the banner of defund the police.
Did the report say, like, and one day there will be these things called Karens, and they will call, like, I mean, the, you know, the prescience here is, you know, it's remarkable.
That's
I mean,
a different
you know,
footnote.
They didn't get the exact name, but they got the description, you know, they were talking about this, and they really kind of nailed it, you know, this essential problem. I mean, it was also interesting because when defund the police came out as an idea, it was a staple of the left, you know, the progressive left, but it had been articulated by people who were straight middle moderate centrists
wow.
in 1968. And so that may say something about where our political dialogue has gone, that a middle of the road liberal idea is now considered really radical.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. There's so much more we could do, but please go out and read this report, especially the new version, which is the work of Jelani Cobb and his colleagues. So Jelani, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
And Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thanks, Jody.
And Kelly Carter Jackson, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. You can get in touch with us with any questions or comments or ideas for the show. Email us thisdaypod@gmail.com, or you can find a form at thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
You need money to hire people and put them to work. And unless you get that kind of money, it just can't be done. I just don't think that Congress recognizes, or it has not been brought home to them severely enough as to what the real problem is.
Well, that was the reason for the Riot Commission report.
Well, evidently it hasn't made any impact.
Radiotopia.